Hey everybody, it's PTF. An explicit content warning. Don't get to do many of these, but this show contains language some may find offensive, as well as very sensitive subject matter. Listen accordingly.
Hello and welcome to an emergency podcast. This is the In the Money Players podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, coming to you from the Little House on the East Side. This is a topic that I've been wanting to talk about in general. And recent events in the world and Twitter have made it more relevant than ever. And the topic is basically race and horse racing, and specifically my co-host and his relationship to those topics. You know him. Most of you love him. A few of you out there, notably on Twitter, apparently don't love him. But we'll get to them maybe, if ever, at some point later in the show. I say it with pride. He's the people's champion for all the winners he gives out. Jonathan Kitchen, what's up, my man?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Pete. I mean, I do want to say something real quick before we get started. Like, this was not Pete's idea, right? I can see someone like thinking that like Pete thought this was a great idea and that we were, you know, this was all, I said it to Pete. And it was almost like in a joke because I've heard a couple people joke about our emergency podcast we've done when there's been like Omaha Beach scratches or whatever. But for me, you know, there's only so much you can capture in characters on Twitter. There's a lot of people you don't want to engage because you don't want to give them the platform. And unfortunately, a lot of these idiots forget that we have a platform and that I have an opportunity to like actually – I can talk about this for 30 minutes and like let someone hear my in-depth thoughts about it. And so this was just – honestly, it was either do this or like talk to someone – like talk to a therapist about just like – you know, I just want to be able to say some I'm going to be 100% me during this. So I want to be able to say some shit that I don't get to always say and that I can't necessarily say on Twitter because it just can get misconstrued. And like I said, I don't want to feed the trolls. So, you know, I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that this is like my idea. This wasn't like Pete calling me being like, hey, we should do a podcast talking about how black you are. That's not how it unfolded.
Well, first of all, just to defend the Omaha Beach emergency pod, he was the morning line favorite for the Derby, who we all picked, scratched the day before. So I do think that rises to the level of emergency. But in all seriousness, I have been very curious just to get your take on some of the stuff happening in the world of sports specifically. And maybe we'll have time to get to some of that after we get past some of the much more important thing. I mean, I've had in my show notes the eyes of Texas written down as something to ask you about on or off air at some point. And we're certainly not going to start there. And it hasn't fit in any shows because it's like, it's hard. The tenor of our shows, you know, when you get into some serious topics, it can be very difficult to segue artfully. And that's why as soon as you mentioned the idea of doing an emergency pod, it just struck me as it's exactly right to have this conversation in a way where we can just have this conversation and then not worry about having to handicap the pick four at Belmont or whatever that would seem, you know, trivial compared to the important things we're talking about. I want to start this conversation, JK, in the past with a little bit of a history lesson. And there's two stories that leapt to mind when this question came up of is JK a black man? And they both involve your dad. And one of them I've always just thought was like a kind of a cool, fun story. And the other one's a really scary, awful story. We'll start with the scary, awful one. How old were you when your dad gave you the talk?
Oh, probably like second grade when, you know, I grew up in Texas, went to a predominantly white school where a majority of my life, you know, this whole conversation will go back and forth where I'm going to say things that people probably are like, I didn't think about it that way, but then I'm also going to like shoot down some things. I'm kind of in the middle like most people are in this world, but that's just not how it all unfolds. So, majority of my life being black has been a feature, not a bug, right? Like the school that I went to, like I like to think that a lot of my coolness in school was earned and I deserved it, but it wasn't, it was kind of cool. Like I was different from other people and I never really realized or noticed that there was a problem. But, you know, I guess maybe when I was in like second grade, some kid, you know, on the playground, he probably didn't even know what he was doing. He called me a ninja. And, you know, I had to ask my dad what it was. And, you know, he told me what it was. And then there's this one day, I don't know if I've told the story before. I snuck up behind my dad I was probably, there's a truck outside, sorry. I was probably, 8, 9, 10, 11. I was playing in the neighborhood. My dad was like fixing the car. And I snuck up behind him and like in a deep voice, I was like, what are you doing, ninja? You know, I thought it was funny. And that was like the first moment like that my dad like really sat me down and broke it down to me. Like I just thought it was funny. Like I thought I was being funny, like kind of trying to scare him or whatever.
Sure.
And he broke it down for me, explained it to me. And I, even in a DM that I received, I had to send a response to that. In that DM, I said that like when my dad taught me how to drive, before he taught me to parallel park, he taught me when I get pulled over to put my hands on the steering wheel. And I still do it to this day. I put my hands on my steering wheel. I hold my fingers up on the steering wheel and I do not move. I don't move. And my dad taught me that. As a black man that grew up in Detroit, in the middle of a significant civil rights crisis in our country, he was just aware, you know? And as I've gotten older, my features, I think, have become more the other. And people always ask me, like when my friends ask me, I think it's funny when we're in like situations, people are like, so what are you? My dad is black. My dad is black from Detroit. And my mom is Sri Lankan. She was born on the island of Sri Lanka. She came here when she was 9 and she lived in Detroit and grew up in Detroit. And in fact, her father was racist. He was upset that my mom married my dad because he had worked in a meatpacking thing with a bunch of like black dudes and they were mean to him. And so he had this perception of that black men were a problem. And funny enough, you know, as a Sri Lankan man, a brown man himself, he had like developed that prejudice. And I didn't really have a great relationship with him as I got older, because I think my mom told me that, or my dad told me that, or someone told me that. And so I was like, man, well, you know, F this dude, like, you know, whatever. But so yes, that's, you know, probably second grade is when I had to talk. And then, and ironically in this day and age, I had to have a talk with my son recently. And everyone who's seen Austin knows that, you know, he's a biracial kid that, I mean, he's like a white kid to a certain extent. He's a tan white kid, really. But he goes to a predominantly white school with a lot of pickup trucks outside. 80% of that school voted in a way that I felt like it was a conversation I had to have with him. If that offends you, then, you know, sorry. But it was a conversation that I had to have with him about what that was and what that is. What are you looking for, bud?
There he is.
It's right in here. Grab it. In here. Oh, well, I don't know. Just...
We're 100% leaving this in, by the way.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The timing is amazing.
But what do you mean?
You have to have paper in there somewhere, dude. All right. How's that for real?
That was about as real as it gets. Okay. And I have a feeling my little one's going to be down here in a minute asking me the same question. But we'll cut out the parent interruption. We're leaving in the Austin one.
Yeah. So I had the conversation with him about what it was, you know, and about these riots and things that are going on and why people are upset. And, you know, I want him to, you know, so anyways, that's my long answer to your question about when I realized.
It's so hard because, I mean, one of the things that just makes it so difficult, especially in a forum like Twitter, is there's just no room for nuance. I feel like I could put my absolutely true opinions out in the world, as could you, and I feel like I'd get pilloried from both sides of the equation as somebody who is both pro-change and pro-cop. It's like it just blows people's minds. But much more importantly, let's get back to your life. Tell the story that I love. About it's another story about being black and your dad walking the streets of Detroit with you when you were little and you're not quite sure what was going on. I'm sure I've cued you enough to know what the story I want to hear.
Yeah, damn, the whole time I was like, what is he talking about? All right, so I've always, you know, now as an adult and even when I was a kid, I used to travel all the time. So we would go back to Detroit all the time and I was always kind of, you know, inquisitive and paying attention or whatever to what's going on around me. And we would be walking around these streets of Detroit and like downtown went to go like, you know, my dad wanted to get a Coney Island hot dog where he grew up, wanted to get, you know, whatever. And he'd be, you know, like, you know, kind of giving the what's up nod to people, like the chin up, hey, what's up? And he kept doing it. And I was like, damn, dad, how do you know all these people? He's like, oh, I don't know. I was like, well, why do you keep like saying hi to him? He's like, no, that's just what we do, bro. you know, my dad talks real fast, says, bro, like, that's what we do, bro. You know, you see a brother, you say, what's up to him? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, that's what we do. And I was like, oh, geez, I had no idea. So that was like this introduction to like this like brotherhood, this idea that we're like all on the same team, this acknowledgement of one another. And to be honest with you, I still, you know, I don't go out of my way or anything, but you know, if you're in an unfamiliar place, that's anything though. Right, if I'm in an unfamiliar place and I see a guy with a derby shirt on, I'm saying what's up to him. Like from a distance, like I see you, dog, like same page, you know. Or if I'm in an airport and I see a guy with a Texas Longhorns hat on, I nod to him. We're on the same team. I see you. We got something in common. Well, if I'm in a predominantly situation or predominantly white situation and I see another brother, I'm like, what's up, my man? Like I see you. Like same team. You know, and so that was kind of an introduction to that I had forgotten about. Yeah, that's funny.
Do you feel like you have that same connection? This is maybe a weird question, but whatever. We're just being honest and open. Do you feel like you have that same connection to black viewers when you're doing your work on Fox? Do you feel like you're representing essentially the way you're describing in those interactions?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like I'm representing. I've always taken pride in being thrust into a situation and changing stereotypes. Always taken pride in that. My entire life, I've taken pride in, of debunking people's prejudice, right? And so, as a formally educated, although like I didn't, you know, I'm not like some scholar by any means.
Not when it comes to math, we know that.
No, of course not. But the idea that there's someone sitting on their couch that has this perception that black men are whatever they believe them to be, I find a sense of joy in changing that. Our friend Jake Ballas yesterday, I didn't tell you the story yet. Jake Ballas went to go, he was buying a house and doing like a construction loan, and he was at a bank in the middle of nowhere, Kentucky, an hour from Lexington. So that tells you that it's in the middle of nowhere. And there was he was sitting at the boardroom talking about horse racing, and the guy, the president of the bank, started talking about watching racing on the weekends and talking about this guy that sits in his basement that gives picks, and he's really, really good. And Jake was the one who had to say, you mean the black guy with like the fro? That guy didn't even say that. He didn't, you know, and like, so I have, there's a part of me that takes a lot of pride in that. It makes me feel like that. And then the other thing is like, you know, one of the reasons, and I'm sure this person's name will come up a few times, because I don't give a damn. Like I usually don't like giving people this type of credit, like saying their names, but for whatever reason, like Barry Spears has this like following. I mean, and I don't think it's that big of a following. And honestly, he follows like 5,000 people and 3,000 people follow, 4,000 people follow him.
Don't be petty, JK.
No, I'm being petty. But, you know, the thing about the, you know, I was really offended last summer, man. And I told you about that too. I was offended that, you know, someone had brought to my attention, there's a Facebook page or post or group of people that were like making fun of me. And he was like the ringleader in that. He's the one who started the meme of the clown face on my face or whatever. And the bad part about it is I reached out to him because I had his cell phone number, Pete, because you and I gave him an opportunity on that DRF tournaments thing to like do a video for us.
Sure, we got him a little check and you know, right. He was somebody before this incident you described, somebody who I looked out for and enjoyed. He would occasionally post something interesting about race. And I know he has had some, you know, as a black man in America, shocker, some harrowing experiences. And he was somebody I always considered an ally, though the story you're telling now changed that, I would have to admit.
Right. And so my initial thought was, and this is how some black people think, and maybe not all, but some, and me sometimes too, is like, I thought to myself, like, damn, dude, like, here I am, a black dude on TV who's broken the requirements of most, right? I'm allowed to, I have a tattoo, a sleeve tattoo. I wear my hair kind of however I want. They let me wear whatever I want. I don't have to wear a suit and tie like everyone else. I'm allowed to just kind of have fun. And here he is in an audience of predominantly white people, like making fun of me. And maybe it shouldn't matter that it's that predominant audience, but it did to me. It bothered me. So what I did was I texted him because that's – I knew him. I texted him. I was like, dude, like, what's up? Like, why are you – you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I just said, like, I just don't understand why, like, why you wouldn't be celebrating me rather than, like, knocking me down. And then he was just, like, telling me how he thinks the shirts are stupid or whatever. And I said, well, let's hop on a call and chop it up. And he never followed through with that. Oh, I'm busy this week. I'll call you next week. Never called, never followed through, whatever. And then he just continuously takes shots. But one thing I don't understand is, like, in reading that piece that Teresa did, and one thing I just don't understand is, like, so you want Black advancement. You want Black empowerment. You feel like there needs to be more Black track handicappers, but you are unfairly tearing down one of them because you either believe that A, he's not Black, B, he's not Black enough, he picks too many favorites, or he wears ugly shirts. Like, really, that's his argument. What else is it? I mean, he's got another argument.
There's a fill me in. It's not an argument, but there is an Occam's razor solution, and I think you've probably seen this from haters across the board, which is the people, when you do have success and you have a job that somebody else thinks they should have or whatever, they get jealous and maybe they say unfortunate things.
Video that he posted for us.
I did not.
I'll submit that to Tony Alivato and Eric Donovan and Mike Mulville at Fox and see if they're interested in having them on the show.
What is this video? You have to explain.
No, the video that he did for us for the DRF. Remember we did that video thing for DRF tournaments where we would post the 30-second, 45-second handicapping video and we had him do it one time?
Yes. Yeah, I remembered him being part of the marketing campaign. I'd forgotten about the videos. Yeah.
He had on a wrinkled Daily Racing Form shirt and a headband. Like, come on, dude. Like, come on. You know what I'm saying? Like, be happy. Celebrate your fellow horse player. And you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. And look, man, to me, it's too, like, self-endearing to say that it's jealousy. Because I just don't understand it. So to answer your question in a long roundabout way, I have – and I've said this to a lot of people in this political climate we're in. And you can take this for what it is. But as a Black man, I'm allowed to say this. My 37 years on this earth, going to an all-white school, predominantly white, higher socioeconomic school in a very fairly rich neighborhood in Dallas-Fort Worth, going to the University of Texas, which predominantly white with obviously a handful of browns and other colors mixed in. Like, I've never in my life – in my entire life felt more Black than I feel. And I've felt since 2016, just never felt more Black. I've never been more aware of situations of race. I've never been more aware of the looks I get when I'm walking with my white girlfriend. You know, I told a story on this airwaves before about that $500 picture of Mike Smith that I bought.
I have that on my list of stories to tell. You want to do that one now, or you?
Yeah, that was purely out of I'm going to prove these MFers wrong. That dude. Now look. I'm not like I said. I'm not stupid. I get it. I had on shorts. I had on a backpack, and I have a sleeve tattoo. None of those things have anything to do with being Black. But I was going to a party on the rooftop in Del Mar where everyone else had on shorts. Maybe I was in the minority of having a backpack, but there wasn't very many Black people, if there was any, outside of myself.
You were invited to this party, I presume.
Yeah, I was invited to a party. I was on the little list thing or whatever, and the guy just was like giving me a hard time about getting in, like making me get someone to verify that I was who I said I was, and then I got to get in.
After people in the similar state just walked right by who
– Right. All of – yeah. Like all my friends like walked in, you know. And I just felt – at that moment, I just felt like I wanted – and it just so happened to be that he moved from the door to hosting that auction. And he was like, $100, $100, $100. And I, with more pride and a mix of pride and vitriol, I said $500. And he looked at me like I was shocked. He was shocked. And then I won the thing and I pulled out a wad of cash and paid him $500 and gave him my address and said, yeah, go ahead and send that to me.
You left out the best part of the story.
Then I forgot.
I'm tempted to edit it, but I'll just leave it on as a coda. How the I guess there was somebody else emceeing with him, an associate of ours, to use a loose term in California, who like did a whole spiel after you made the bid. One of the top handicappers in America, Jonathan Kitchen, the NHC Tour champion, has just bid $500. And then the look on the doorman's face got a little peaked. Is that the word I want? Peaked?
I just said I was almost formally agitated. but let me explain that a little bit. Now, do I think that's the way that I should go about life every day? No. But for whatever reason, I just felt backed in a corner there. And I felt like I felt like I needed to lash out. Cause I've never really been that. I've never really, like I said, I've never felt more black than I feel now. Like my entire life, I've never interviewed for a job and not got it. I've never, there's so many things, but I realized throughout my life, even as I got older, when I was coaching at Plano East, that school was interesting because it was the largest enrollment in the state of Texas. So the biggest school in the state of Texas, largest enrollment. We had the richest kid in Plano ISD went to that school. The poorest kid in Plano ISD went to that school. It was a mix of rich white elite and poor black apartments. It was a mix of that. And so I was there for 4 years and I had receivers. So I always had like, you know, three starting black receivers and one white kid. That's like how it always was. And so I really had to bring those kids along within that environment. But then I also, you know, it was a very interesting lesson in race. And I had a lot of kids that I loved and cared about. One kid in particular, who, and this is one of my biggest kind of soapboxes for when it comes to racism and systemic racism in this country, is like, he was a great kid, phenomenal kid. His mom was a piece of trash. And at one point she wouldn't drive him to school for morning meetings at 6 o'clock. We had meetings early. He was on varsity as a sophomore. She wouldn't drive him to school. So she would give him her car. He would drive to school, do the meetings. And then at lunchtime, instead of eating lunch, he would drive home, pick her up. She would bring him back to school. Well, one day he was driving to school and he got pulled over. He was 15. He didn't have a license and he got a ticket. And he couldn't work. He was 15. He was on varsity football. He's got school. He's got football. It's just hard to have a job in that setting. He's 15. So he gets this ticket. His mom doesn't take any responsibility for the ticket. She doesn't pay for the ticket. And a year later, he's driving home after he's driving home, still without a license, and he gets pulled over. And he gets arrested for that warrant, for that ticket that he never had. At that night when he was in jail, he called his mom. She couldn't come get him. Then he called me. It was the night before Zenyatta lost the blame. And I said, listen, dude, I don't want to interfere. I'm going to let your mom try to figure this out. But tonight, if she hasn't came and got you, I'll come get you. And so at that night when he was in jail, he had four siblings. They were all in jail at the same time. So in his brain and in his life, that was normal. It was normal for him to be in jail. His siblings were all in jail. So he got this ticket and he broke the mold, special kid, went to college, graduated, great kid. Now, the other kids that I had that were in similar situations, they're still in and out of prison. And part of me used to feel like a failure for that, right? But I did everything I did for Gabe that I did for those other kids. And I just felt like I had to teach myself that it wasn't me. It wasn't my failure. It was the system's failure. It's getting these kids in the system at a young age, getting them to plea out of deals because they don't have the money or the knowledge or the respect for themselves or their families to not plea on some situation, some bad situation they got themselves into, to fight it, to not get a felony on their record. And then when they do something stupid later in life, then now they're in the system. And then they get out, they can't get a job. And I feel like that's probably one of the biggest inequities in this world. And so my point being is like, I've learned a lot about being black and how it affects and what it means. But I have to understand and respect the fact that it hasn't necessarily been the largest handicap for me. Personally, you know what I mean? But I still respect it and understand it.
Well, you've got that firsthand experience, even if it's for your role more as a coach and a teacher and a mentor. And I've seen you, this isn't a story that you're going to want to bring up, but I will to listeners. I've seen you like leave nice dinners to remember the story out in California. You offended a friend's wife or girlfriend because you sort of went missing in dinner because I forgot how you got rapping with him, but there was a kid in the parking lot that was, you know, going through some stuff that you ended up spending your dinner talking to this kid. And I just remember thinking, I don't know how much you remember about this, if there's any story to tell there, but I just remember thinking that it definitely showed a commitment to helping people that must have been born in your days teaching, that you would eschew the usual four cocktails and fantastic meal to spend your time trying to help somebody out. What do you remember about that kid in that conversation?
Yeah, I was on the phone. I think I was trying to coordinate with someone that was traveling to California at that point. And then there was a young man outside. I think he was selling something. And I just got caught talking to him. You know, that was one of the things that when I coached and taught, there was three things I hated about it. The hours were tough, 90 hours a week for 15 weeks in a row. And you were never really off. You always had the responsibility of those young men that were your players. The other thing was the pay. It wasn't very good. That kind of sucked. And then having to deal with teachers, you know what I mean? The teacher in the hallway that stopped you and asked you for your hall pass when you weren't even in their class, having to deal with all of them, going to faculty meetings and all that ridiculousness. Those are the three things that sucked. The coaches were great. The kids were great. And one thing that I miss most of all was the opportunity to help young men. Because I think one thing that, at least at that age, when I was 23, 24, 25, 26, and even now, even though I'm 37, I think some people kind of get shocked by that. Just by the way I dress, the fact that I have this tattoo, my hair, the way I kind of carry myself, the way I act, I feel like I have a unique ability to talk to young people where they don't look at me and say, dude, you don't understand. And so anytime I find an opportunity to be able to teach someone some of the lessons that I've either learned personally or I've witnessed, I want to try to teach them, you know? And that kid, Gabe, I got him a job with one of my high school friends. And before he went to work, I had to teach him. I said, look, dude, there's a difference between being proud of who you are and finding an appropriate way to enter into a situation, whatever it might be. It's got nothing to do with being black or white, but you don't go into a room full of women and yell fuck, right? You just don't do that. So you also don't go to a professional workplace sagging your pants. I'm not saying there's a problem with sagging your pants. That's how you want to get down and you know, at the club or wherever you're at or hanging out with your boys. I don't give a damn. Do whatever you want to do. But there's things that are socially acceptable and you can't fall back on, oh, well, you know, that was one thing I used to get all the time with kids. And so I got used to saying it. Coach, she just don't like me because I'm black. Coach, you don't understand. She won't say none of the white kids in the class. They be like, but I, you know, I'm like, dude, no, you're an idiot. That's why she's mad. And I'm sure that I love you and you're an idiot. So I know she can't handle it, you know? And just trying to teach these kids that there's a way to operate in this world. And I never wanted them to have that crutch. Now, it's a real thing. And it's a real thing you have to be aware of and you have to respect. But I didn't want them as young men to develop that habit. And I'm not saying that that's what most people do and a lot of people are doing. I mean, there is systemic racism in this country that holds people down and it's clear as day. And it goes deeper than police brutality and all that other crap. But I just, you know, I've always found it to be rewarding to have those conversations with young men. And look, and it ain't a black or white thing. We took a kid that I coached in high school that – two kids that I coached in high school that – didn't need Coach Kenshin. Two kids that went to University of Texas, graduated with MBAs and lived in Austin. So I kind of reconnected with them when they came down here to go to school. We took them to the Derby 3 times. So it ain't just like I'm out here throwing out charity cases for black kids. Those kids will tell you the same thing that the black kids will tell you, that I tried to teach them about the world they were entering into. So it's always been something that I've appreciated, and I do miss doing it.
You could probably make an argument that those white kids need some of those lessons more, if not just as much as the black kids you were dealing with, especially given you know, some of the divide in this country. So I think that's an important point to make. Back to this idea of your blackness, though, JK. How does it? I mean, I try to avoid asking questions that start, how does it make you feel? But I think this, I'm going to make this the exception that proves the rule. When you hear other black men questioning your blackness, how does that make you feel?
You know, what's funny is, like, growing up, I gravitated towards, I mean, most of my friends, I mean, I had a lot of friends, but like, I mean, I had a lot of white friends, black friends, Mexican friends. I mean, I had like everything. I can think of like all of my best friends throughout school. They were all different colors throughout the world. But then when I was in high school, I kind of started hanging out with some of like two of like the best athletes, and they happened to be black, and I kind of started hanging out with them. They were older than me. And so I kind of was always with them. So I was the young one within that group of popular black kids. They used to always kind of, you know, jack with me a little bit about being mixed. They used to always try to hook me up with this other mixed girl who's now an actress and was in that, was in Charlie's Angels. And she's, and anyway, I should have done it.
we'll just leave that alone before we get you in trouble.
But and so they always used to kind of mess with me about it. But like I said, it was always kind of a bonus for me. We were, you know, we were the guys that kind of stood off to the side, and, you know, everyone loved us still. We were still friends with every group. It was kind of a bonus for us. And so going with them to their cousin's house, you know, like going with those kids to their cousin's house who lived in South Dallas, and then you're sitting in there whoever wants to perceive as black, like, that was a new world for me. And I would feel a little out of place because I spoke maybe a little bit more properly than they did. I never felt like I couldn't say the N-word. If I talk to my brother, I say the N-word. Like, if I'm telling a story, I'd be like, ninja, this dude called me talking about, like, well, that when I talk to my brother, like, I talk that way with my brother. I stopped doing it as much in public as I used to because it's, you know, whatever. Everyone understands why, but I've always kind of gotten that not black enough thing, but it never really bothered me, you know? Everyone knows mixed babies are cute, right? Mixed teenagers are cute too. So I was fine with it. It didn't bother me, right? I just dealt with it. But I think now hearing it from the people that it was brought to my attention that started the conversation yesterday, I think, you know, and Jake Ballas tweeted today, well, what does that mean? I think that's important. Like, what do you mean not all the way black, not black enough? Because I feel really confident about one of the things I said in my note in a response to one of those people was, I can tell you one thing. There's people on their couch and behind their keyboards that are calling me the same ninja that they call you. If that's black enough for you, then let me know. But my thing is, it's offensive because I don't understand what it means. Do I speak too properly? Am I not dark enough? Does my mom's Sri Lankan-ness cancel out my dad's blackness? I mean, I got a lot of mixed friends that went through a lot of the same shit that I've gone through, and maybe even worse. Mike Epps, he's 50-50, black, white. Actually, he's black, light-skinned mom, but he looks black, white. And he still gets it. My brother's mother is a light-skinned black woman, and she produced, if you look at that picture I tweeted, I have two brothers. One of them's dark and one of them's lighter, but they have the same mom. He's just a light dude, but is he not black enough because he's not dark enough? But he grew up in Detroit as a straight black kid, went to like all black school, straight up. So for me, it's frustrating because I'm like, well, what do I need to do to be more black? Just fill me in on the checklist of blackness, and I'll be sure when I wake up every day, I'll brush my teeth, I'll take my vitamins, and I'll do one of those things that makes me black enough for you. But I can tell you right now, my hair is pretty damn black. I look pretty damn black. My skin's pretty damn black. I don't have to use sunscreen. My tattoos aren't as colorful as I'd like them to be. You know, just let me know. Let me know what I need to do to. So it's you know, I tweeted. It's somewhere in the between annoying and funny to me. It's not hurtful. It's just annoying and funny. And it's funny that it's coming from. It's coming from a person for sure that there's some jealousy, and it's coming from another person who I think the jealous person got into his ear. So one of them is kind of dead to me. The other one is the door is open. You know what I'm saying? Well, the door is open, and I ended a message with, I look forward to shaking your hand one day. And I mean that. people get misinformed. I don't hold grudges. You know what I'm saying?
From an outsider perspective, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, and maybe I was misinterpreting, but maybe you
I'm black enough to give you a pass here. I'm just kidding. People get really pissed off about that.
No, I don't need I don't need that pass. I don't need that. I don't need the ninja pass. I worried from afar. I thought the implication was that you were an Uncle Tom.
Do I believe that I do anything that is degrading, disparaging, hurtful to black people? No. So I would find that to be offensive. But at the same time, like, and I even said in the email I sent, like, feel what you guys are saying to me feels a little Candace Owens-y.
Well,
which we talked about recently, Pete, is like, I feel like she's built a political career on the fact that the extreme right white can use her as their trophy or puppet of like, well, look, it's not racist because our black girl says it's not. And then she's taken and run with that. And maybe she believes a lot of it. And God bless her if she does. But she then, with that platform, has degraded, disparaged, and kind of taken away from the argument of the Black Lives Matter movement and just other people that are taking a stance against racial injustice. So, I did get that. I got a mix of like, you're not black enough, which is the high school version of Uncle Tom. They would probably need to elaborate more if they felt like I was like, you know, if I was Samuel L. Jackson and Django Unchained, I'd like to see that argument, but I didn't take that necessarily from what they were saying, but I did take it from the teenage version of Uncle Tom.
I'm glad you're keeping an open mind, because from everything I hear, one of the folks we've been subtweeting throughout this show is not wouldn't be a guy I would think would have – I would think you and he would have more in common than not in common. I guess we'll learn more about that as time goes on. I do want to extend this conversation, JK, just from you to the industry at large. You referenced the article that Teresa Gennaro wrote, which I thought had some really interesting quotes in it, specifically one from Alicia Hughes from the NTRA about how racing is a sport, and this is absolutely true, that was largely built with a lot of black contributions, especially in the saddle, but also obviously taking care of horses back in the day, all the way through now. There was, just like in baseball, black jockeys were banned at one point, not with a decree, but by sort of a silent agreement among owners that they wouldn't be used anymore, allowing the likes or forcing the likes of Jimmy Wingfield to go ride all over the world after having captured whatever it was, three derbies, I think, in his case. But despite having these roots with the black community, despite there being plenty of black fans from what I could see, it hasn't translated to black people being in positions of power in horse racing. Is this something you see as a problem? Do you have any ideas of how it might be dealt with?
Yeah, so this is tough because, like, yeah, I, in most things in this world, I think a good comparison, but at least a starting off point, and then I'll come back to that because it'll help what I say come off cleaner. The conversation of African-American coaches in the NFL. Why is there a lack of African-American coaches in the NFL? Majority, I don't know the number, but there's a ton of African-American assistant coaches that are ex-players and non-ex-players. The majority of players in the NFL are African-American. Why is it that all the head positions in these teams are typically are white and in a way that it doesn't really match up to the composition of the NFL from a coaching staff standpoint and also from a player standpoint? And I think that it's fair that a majority of the teams are owned by rich, old white men. And so I can understand that there could be some prejudice built in there. There could be relationships. There could be lots of different reasons as to why that exists. But I do believe there's an inequality there and something that needs to be addressed. I think the Rooney Rule is somewhere between necessary and offensive, like when you have to interview a black person, you know what I mean? Like, I just think I get it, but I don't get it, but I kind of get it, but it can't not be there, but it really shouldn't be there type of deal. But what I do, so when it comes to racing, I don't feel like, there is a lack of black people in positions, higher positions in racing because of racism. I think that the systems of racism in this country are why there aren't black people in positions of power in racing. And what I mean by that is that if you think about it, think about the black groom or black exercise rider. What is his journey to becoming a trainer? He has to have success for a successful barn, and then he has to have usually either a backer to go out on his own with an owner who's willing to blah blah blah, you know, to give him horses, to give him an opportunity. I think of someone like Rudolph Brissett, who started with Bill Mott. He's with a Hall of Famer, and then when he goes out on his own, Winstar supported him. Winstar sent him horses. Other Mike Ryan sent him horses. Lots of people sent him horses. And then conversely, if someone like Nick Bush wanted to be, and I don't know Nick that well personally, just like saying hello to him or whatever. I mean,
he could be the smartest man in the world. A black man, star exercise rider, works for Todd Pletcher.
Exercised. I think Always Dreaming maybe, and has worked for you know, that big operation. So if Nick were trying to make that transition, Nick would need to have the financial backing to make that move. I don't know how Rudolph got started. I don't know if someone gave him money to get started, or if he had just saved a bunch of money, or if his family has. I have no idea. But I'm just saying Nick would have to then get an owner to then entrust in him, whatever. And unfortunately, in a Southern dominated sport, in a white dominated ownership situation, it's going to be an uphill battle. He's going to start a little bit behind from where someone else might start. Not saying he can't do it or he couldn't do it. Or maybe he's got some character flaws that are throwing him. I mean, I'm just giving an example. And so for me, that's because they're – so then it goes to the next step. Well, why aren't there black owners in racing? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, there is without a doubt there's socioeconomic disparity in this country where if you are a black man, you are more likely to find yourself impoverished for lots of reasons that – systemic reasons in this country, how things have all unfolded. We talked about the justice system, getting behind the eight ball, a 15, 16 year old rich white kid who gets a DUI and hits someone has a much better chance of having a successful life than a 16 year old black kid who does the same thing, just the way that it is. And so to me, there's a lack of black ownership that would give that black trainer the opportunity. And there's a lack of black ownership because there's a disparity in economic distribution in this country. And so to me, it's less about racism and racing, keeping these people from these positions, but more about the bigger picture problems in our country that are keeping these people from being interested in racing.
I think it's a really interesting point you make. I hadn't thought about it that way. And based on what you said about the Rooney Rule, this might be where you and I have a little bit of difference on this. Like, I believe that the only way to fix both of these issues and some of this inequality in general is through proactive measures. Like, I know, I totally get why affirmative action isn't like a super popular policy, but I believe it's absolutely worth the negatives that come with it for the potential positives of just trying to give people chances. And I believe that with the Rooney Rule. I know it's imperfect, but it's one of these things where sometimes you have to look if you got to look at your problem and you got to look at the solution to the problem and you got to see which one does a better job on balance. And to me, there's got to be some more active measures to getting more black people involved in the sport, either on the horseman side or the owner side, or once they're involved in the owner side, getting them on some of those boards, which are, you know, again, maybe not through racism, but you look at them in the context of the modern world and they're uncomfortably lily white and they're kind of still a little bit uncomfortably male. And right. I'm in favor of taking those dramatic measures. As I said, I don't have all the answers. I don't pretend to have all the answers now, but if there's anything I can do in terms of just lending my brainstorming to anybody in racetrack positions of power who's interested, I'd like to put my money where my mouth is and offer my brain or my pen or anything I can have in the direction of trying to do something about these issues. Because at the end of the day, you know, you make a great point. Maybe it's not, you know, racism per se. Maybe it's more something that's systematic, but that doesn't mean it isn't a problem. And I would imagine you agree with that piece of it at least.
No, it's definitely a problem. Yeah, I'm not discounting the whole idea of the movement. I just think that I think that we would do – we could do ourselves some favors in this country by looking more into – like I feel like everything we do is like – because of maybe just the way the world is, we look at the surface and of issues rather than going deeper as to finding the root of the problem. Mm-hmm. I even do it in like relationships. I don't try to focus on so much about why we're fighting about the dishes. I want to focus on the part deeper that we can fix, that the root that is causing that issue, that we can then resolve that, because the dishes then won't matter. And for me, the fact that there's no, you know, there's not a lot of black involvement in boards and racing and higher positions of power in racing, I think more than focus on why that's the case, we should focus more on why from the base level there's less, there's not as many black people involved at any point. I mean, I can think of, and I'm going to blow this badly, but like I can think of Naj at Naira as a black, you know, not executive, but a behind track the desk management. Black man in racing and track management. And I'm probably going to blow it and forget about someone else. You know, I can think of the gentleman that works is the president of Equibase. I'm drawing a blank on his last name, but Jason Wilson. I'm trying, you know, so my point being is rather than why is there not, how can we make at the base level? And so, and I think the same is with police brutality. I think it's less about what happened in Minneapolis when that man was murdered, and more about how did we get to that point, and let's cut it there. Rather, you know, let's cut it there and fix it there rather than just trimming off the tips of that plant. Let's cut it off at the root rather than trimming the tip. And that's actually probably a tougher conversation. So I'm not discounting the fact that, you know, defunding the police or putting those men in prison for the rest of their lives is cutting off the tip. Let's change how we hire police officers. Let's change how we train police officers. Let's change the base relationship between the black community and law enforcement.
You know, that's I love data, and data actually comes into this argument, and you see how much better a job based on, you know, various data points a police force can do when you're talking about a minority area, when you have at least, I forget what the specific percentage of the force is being the same minority ethnicity as in the area. I mean, that really struck me that there are, it's not like, oh, well, this is the way it is. There's nothing we could do. There are things that can be done. And I'm glad you looped it back to the police, because I did, you know, I mentioned I'm pro cop before, and obviously I'm not pro cop brutality, but no. to me, only in the outrage machine of Twitter do those two ideas get conflated. You know, I think the same percentage of bad cops is probably the same percentage of protesters who aren't really protesters, but are just people out there looking for blood and to cause harm. It's a very small amount of people that the other side will point to and think that they're representative of the whole. And I think in both cases, it's wrong. This reminds me of a story I've never been able to tell on the show because it would have just seemed like too inappropriate. But since we're talking about these sensitive issues anyway, I'm just going to go ahead and make the joke. Do you remember like 3 years ago at Keeneland, the Bormans were on vacation in England and I was staying at Casa Borman in fancy part of Lexington there. And somehow there was like a new alarm system or something. And somehow the code had gotten mixed up. So I arrived very late at night. I got a flight. I got in there at midnight. I went around back. I put in the code. It didn't work. I put in the code again. And like an alarm started going off. And I ended up, you know, preemptively calling the police myself just to tell them like, no, I'm not breaking in. I'm supposed to be here. But I do remember, you know, the cops rolled up and they were perfectly nice. And they don't deserve this comment. And I hope people won't get too offended by this, but I do remember saying to you, JK, it was the first time in our friendship that I was really glad that you weren't with me.
Dude, if that would have been me, I'm not joking. If that would have been me, I would have went, I would have went out to the front. I would have stood in a light, and I would have. And as soon as a cop car pulled up, I would have literally showed my hands. I'm dead serious. That's what I would have done. And
it's not fun. I laugh, but it's not. I laugh.
No, of course.
I don't cry, I suppose.
No, of course. And I think, you know, for me, so, and I'm not, I don't know all the facts about what happened in Atlanta in that Wendy's parking lot, but one of the things that I know to be true is that a lot of these situations where these black men start to resist or run or do whatever, to me, it's looking at the in-depth reasons as to why that happened. It's because 4 years ago, they got arrested for something and didn't have the money, education, or legal support to fight it. They pled on a 10-year probation where if they got caught doing something else again, they were going to go to jail for 10 years. And so when they get pulled over for DUI, they're running. Or they're fighting or they're resisting because they, you know, he wasn't committing a violent crime. He was passed out in a parking lot, you know? And so I think that it's a lot of those inequities and a lot of these issues go back to the systemic problems. And so, like I said, not discounting the movement or the attention or the problem or the immediate need for justice in those situations. But my focus is more on fixing things at a higher level, you know? So.
And that this probably leads back to the eyes of Texas thing, but yeah, just to button it up and explain, if folks are confused about my standing, like I'm a full, like you, a full believer in some systematic reform, but you know, the people taking it to an extreme level and questioning. I mean, nothing made me angrier than that ACAB graffiti. That's just an absolute load of horseshit. You know, most cops are very, very, very few cops are bad. And the idea to blame them all is, you know, I just patently know from my own family is ridiculous. But, you know, again, I think you could be pro cop and still be, you know, I'm sure I have some ideas about reform that my brother and I would disagree with. And that's okay. You know, there's room for subtlety in these things that doesn't get to have a place online. And that brings us back to the eyes of Texas, because to me, on one level, the idea that the song is offensive, I mean, there's just like a total disconnect with me. But my attitude, and this is what I really wanted to ask you about, but my attitude is, hey, if these black men on this football team are telling me that this offends them, like, who the hell am I to tell them that they're wrong? And I'd be tempted to defer to them. But you, as a proud Texan, as a UT alum, what do you think of this? I mean, I know you said you're not interested in trimming the tops and you want to get to the to the roots, but I just want your opinion on it.
Well, I've you know, I almost cry when I hear the song. You know, it's a sense of pride for me as someone who didn't take high school very seriously, to the times that I walked around that campus with people that did take high school seriously, and to see them double take and look at me, and the pride that I felt for my family and for myself when I graduated from there. You know, hearing that song, and it means something to me, taking my son to those games and teaching him the right way to do it, and being able to identify that if you thrust your horns forward at the wrong part of the song, you clearly didn't go to Texas. You're just a fan. I love it. There's nothing in the song itself from a lyrical standpoint that suggests or infers racism. The tune of the song is to I've been working on the railroad. And when it was written, obviously, most of the people that were working on that railroad were men of color, black men. And so when it was introduced and performed back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whenever the hell it was, they performed it often in blackface because that's who was working on the railroad. And it became a song that they were very proud of, and it became our school song. If you are offended by that, I respect that and I have no issue with it. But one thing I will say about, and this can maybe pivot into the statue thing. There's one thing I will say. I've talked to a few friends about this. I'm never going to tell anyone what they should be offended by. But for me personally, I think that as our world grows and progresses, people are always going to have taken part in things that at the time were socially acceptable and we weren't aware of were problematic. And they were doing things that were the norm then. I'm guilty of that in a lot of different ways. A word that I used to use all the time that I never use anymore is retard. I used to say, oh, that's retarded, that's retarded, that's retarded. I don't do that anymore because I wasn't aware of it then. I wasn't trying to be hurtful or harmful or whatever, but it was brought to my attention as I grew up that it wasn't okay. So if I had Twitter back in the day and I texted one of my boys, you're a retard, like someone could bring that up and like show it and then like say that I'm like a bad person because of that. Also, I used to say all the time, that's gay. Don't do that anymore. That was something I used to do back in the day. Someone brought it to my attention. How would you like it if I said, that's so black? Ugh, I wouldn't like that very much. Don't do that anymore. One of the things, the F word. I don't say the F word all the time, which is a word that we used to throw around all the time playing video games and arguing with friends when I was in high school and I was a teenager. Another thing that I learned from and don't participate in any longer. Back at some point, interracial marriage and couples were a problem for a lot of people. That's why I could care less about gay marriage or LGBTQ rights and things like that.
When you say you could care less, you mean you're in favor of it.
I could care less about what someone does. I'm not offended by it. I'm not going to, whatever, dude. Like someone thought that me marrying my girlfriend or my previous marriage that I created, the thing I love the most in this world and my son, is problematic. And so I'm not going to. My point is that these students at the University of Texas that performed this song in blackface, man, they probably didn't know any better. And the chances are they're either dead or they're converted or who gives a damn. And I worry about bringing people's past up as they're trying to change. I think that's a little bit unfair. Now, Confederate statues. Those statues are for honoring men and women and celebrating men and women. And I don't think that people that lost their lives one reason or another fighting for some of the oppression of people or people that need to be, you know, statued, right? In the moment that that happens, then let's pop up a maximum security statue out in front of Churchill, right? Pop it up. He won. He crossed the wire first. You know what I mean? Like we're celebrating him. We don't want to forget our history. We don't want to forget where we came from. So, you know, I look at each issue individually. If the Eyes of Texas is removed, am I going to protest or have a problem? No, I'll be sad because I like the song, but I also like people and I respect people's feelings and I respect those black athletes that perform for us on a daily basis. And if they're offended by it, then I stand behind them and I'll never fight for it. I don't fight for removing it, but I'll never fight for keeping it either.
JK, you've covered a lot of ground here today, and I know you got a lot to do. I want you to get about your business. We'll obviously be back later in the week, even later today, with more content that's more geared towards racing. But, you know, I thank you at the end of all of these shows, but I've never thanked you as sincerely as this. Thanks so much for taking time to, I feel like you're educating me and the audience and just talking about difficult stuff to talk about in a way that I think is going to help move this conversation forward. Thank you, my friend.
No doubt, PTF. Love you, Bubba.